Hey everyone, Cave Dan here for the Faithless Brewing Podcast, home to the spiciest tech in the modern format. We've got a great episode today featuring a whole slew of new decks. Some of them are our own creations, and some of them come from brewers like you. Stay tuned to find out how to have your deck featured on a future edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Welcome to week 14 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson out of the Twin Cities, joined by Damon Alexander from a parking lot on the north shore of Lake Superior. Damon, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, way to make it sound super sketchy. I'm just staring at this hotel because that was the closest place with Wi-Fi, where I was on a vacation with my extended family. But it's beautiful up here. It's nice to see them all.
Doing it for the love of the game.
Yeah.
For the people not from Minnesota, the North Shore of Lake Superior is spectacular. It's a big resort area, and it's just very rugged and beautiful. So hopefully you're having a great time up there. Joined by probably also beautiful, although not anywhere close as beautiful, the East Coast, Mr. Dan Schriever, Cave Dan on MTGO. What's going on, Dan?
Hey, guys. I'm doing well. Excited to pack my bags. I'm heading to Minneapolis tomorrow, actually, to see my family and also play a GP. That should be great.
All of the Faithless Brewing Podcasts coming into Minnesota, coming together like Voltron.
Or regular Tron. I don't know. Am I the mine or the power plant?
You're the tower to me, Dan.
Yeah, exactly. You tap for 3 mana.
So we're going to do our best this week. If we sound a little funky, it's because we're recording under some unusual circumstances. Damon has fallen on hard times. He's outside of the hotel looking through the windows at the happy families inside.
I'd say he's falling on good times. He's on the North Shore, sunny.
Walleye.
Yes, exactly.
Walleye is a fish that's kind of, I guess, in northern Minnesota. I don't really know if it's anywhere else in the world. Maybe.
It's a very intelligent fish as well. It's very difficult to catch. So fishermen pride themselves on their ability to catch walleye. So it was a busy weekend in the world of Magic. We had a Mythic Championship 4 in Barcelona, which was modern, of interest to us. There was also a GP in that same format. There was also a Modern Open and Classic, a Modern Mox, and Dan, you played in an ICQ?
I did, yeah. I played in a Star City IQ, the lowest tournament on the totem pole of the ones that we mentioned, but the dearest to my heart.
Let's just start off with your experience playing in that tournament, then. We'll kind of get to the generic results after that.
Yeah, so I was playing. These are basically the 1Ks. We usually get between, let's say, 50 and 70 players. This one had 61 players, I think. So it was 6 rounds with a top 8 cut. I decided to play Niv-Mizzet Reborn. I think it's time to start tuning up for the GP next weekend. It felt like there was still work to be done on the mana base specifically. The change that I wanted to make, the list that I wanted to try, was one that kept the Pillar of the Perrins, you know, this land that taps for any color, but only if you're casting multicolor spells. But also played enough Snowlands, Snow Basics, to run Arkham's Astrolabe, the 1-mana cantrip mana fixer. On top of that, you kind of want one other play, Burns of Paradise being the best one if it survives. There's sort of like a mini discussion slash debate happening on the Niv-Mizzet Discord where, you know, do you want to play Burns of Paradise or not? One of the arguments is always like, well, it's so good in the following scenarios and matchups, it's like the best possible turn one play. But on the other hand, it's vulnerable to things like Lava Dart, Renin 6, Fatal Push. It creates a vulnerability. So I decided instead of playing Birds, I was going to play Search for Tomorrow as my other sort of 1-mana accelerator. And the mana base worked out pretty well, actually. I kind of crushed the Swiss portion of the tournament. I started off 4-0, and at that point, with 2 rounds to play, I could have double drawn to secure top 8, but I knew that my round 5 opponent was on Jund, which is a fantastic matchup. And so I was like, well, why not? I want to get some more testing in, and I'll play for the 1 seed. So crushed him as well. No sir, the ID, just to claim the top seed.
Did you like dream crush him?
Well, I would have felt bad if I had. No, he was actually able to draw in the next round. So then, I ID'd round 6. And then the top 8 ended up getting knocked out in the quarterfinals by a Jeskai Saheeli build. That was a tough matchup. So just to give a sense of how the tournament went, basically, Niv-Mizzet is fantastic against any deck that it is capable of interacting with, because the entire deck is just, you're trying to just trade one for one, even, you know, two for one at your expense is fine, because eventually when you're going to stick a Niv-Mizzet, you're just going to get all the cards. Like, you'll go from having one card in hand to discarding to hand size off a single Niv-Mizzet, because you have so many hits, and some of those hits are cards that find additional Niv-Mizzets, like Bring to Light, or Illidamri's Call is one that I was trying, or Glittering Wish. So basically anything that's like a fair mid-rangey deck that's trying to play for the late game is almost a buy. I played against Eldrazi Tron, Jund twice, and those all fall into that category of decks that I'm just going to go way over the top of them. Those are extremely easy matchups. I also played against Burn and Red Phoenix. Those are also matchups that it's possible to interact with, because so many of the gold cards that you have to play in Niv-Mizzet happen to gain life, so like a full playset of Lightning Helix to start with. But then other stuff that incidentally gains life, Kaya's Guile or Kaya Orzhov Usurper, Knight of Autumn, all kinds of stuff. Basically, any time that I trade my resources for theirs, I'm very happy. So those are all great matchups. The Jeskai Saheeli deck is a little bit different. You guys are familiar with this list?
Yes.
Basically, yeah.
Can you sort of recap how it works?
Yeah, so the key interaction is the copycat one, where the deck seeks to have a Felidar Guardian and a Saheeli Ray, and Saheeli can downtick, and this makes a copy of Felidar Guardian. Felidar Guardian comes into play, can flicker permanent. It flickers your Saheeli. Saheeli resets, and then can flicker Felidar Guardian, not flicker, make a copy of it, and then you have an army, an arbitrarily number of Felidar Guardians with haste that will all die out of turn, and in one brief moment of glory, they will all charge your enemy and deal infinite damage. And then the deck's seen some changes in modern times. That combo's been around since it was, I think, banned from Standard before it even happened. One new card it picked up was Teferi, the 3-mana one, and this lets the deck be a little bit more resilient. It makes it harder for the opponents to interact, because basically anything that can kill a creature or deal basically 1 point of damage to Saheeli after it flickers will interrupt the combo. So it's pretty vulnerable, but Teferi basically stops that. The deck kind of morphed into this Jeskai Super Friends list, just featuring a bunch of like walkers and then a bunch of kind of like combo control cards like Remand and then Path to stay alive.
Right, good stuff. Seer Visions, Lightning Bolts, Lightning Helix, Path, Snapcasters, and then Narset to round out the Super Friends package. Just using that sort of heuristic that I was describing, like, can I interact with this deck given the cards that I'm playing in Niv-Mizzet? The answer is kind of yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, like Damon was saying, it's easy to interrupt the infinite combo, the Splinter Twin combo, because in order to go off, Saheeli has to tick down to one loyalty as part of the loop. So any kind of shock effect, whether that's a Kolaghan's Command or a Lightning Helix or something, or a creature removal, like, will stop that combo. So it shouldn't be that scary, except that darn little Teferi just mucks everything up. He's so bad from the Niv-Mizzet side to play against. He completely just ruins the plan. So what happened in my match was, I was on the play as a top seed. You know, I had a fine draw. Like, I hit my first 5 land drops, which would normally be fine. But because of his Teferis, every time that he played a Teferi, I had to immediately answer it. The way that the Niv-Mizzet deck is set up, most of my interaction is instant speed that destroys a permanent on the battlefield. Unfortunately, because of the Teferi's static ability, like, I can't do that till the next turn. So every time he plays a Teferi, I can't counter it. I just sort of waste my mana that turn. I have to not cast anything else. Like, it's not like I can let it resolve and end step kill it. I have to let it resolve, let him finish his turn, and then go to my turn, sorcery speed, destroy the Teferi if I can. If he's kind enough to downtick it, I can Lightning Helix it. If he just chooses to uptick it, then I have to actually use like a stronger removal, like an Assassin's Trophy, which just accelerates him further towards the sort of critical mass of mana, which is 6 in the standard Jeskai Saheeli decks. 6 lands is what you need to deploy both Felidar Guardian and Saheeli from your hand. You play the Felidar Guardian first, blink one of your tap lands, and that gives you 3 to cast Saheeli. There's a version that can do it with 5 lands with a Mox Amber, but I don't think many people play that. Basically, once he got to 5-6 lands, like, I was in extreme danger of dying, to the point where I couldn't really tap out for Niv-Mizzet without having at least 2 extra lands to have some kind of interaction up at instant speed. And I just couldn't do it because I stopped hitting land drops beyond five, and I had a brief window to cast Niv-Mizzet. It got remanded, and it just didn't work out. So he continued hitting land drops, and eventually, after like the third Teferi time walked me for the third time, I just couldn't stop the combo at that point. But the second game had ended up on an interesting play that I wanted to ask your guys' opinion on. This one went a little bit better. I was able to land an Ice Fang Coetal on turn two to just have something in play that could pressure any Planeswalker that snuck through. And then by chance, I had drawn both of my Izzet Charms and was able to counter two Teferis in a row on turns three and four with them. So I was feeling really good. Flash forward a couple of turns, he went for the combo. He played Felidar and a Saheeli. I had, at that point, two Kolaghan's Commands were my last cards in hand. So I shocked the Saheeli to kill it and made him discard a card. He discarded a Narset, which was kind of surprising because I think that's a great card. So at that point, he has one card in hand. I have a Kolaghan's Command in hand, and I have an Ice Fang in play, and he's at five, I want to say. So the question then was, what do I do with my K Command? Do I fire it off immediately and when I untap to get his last card, which is presumably better than a Narset? Or do I hold it to sort of just try to get something else out of it, interrupt the combo again? It protects me from a second copy of the Felidar Saheeli combo because the Felidar was still in play. I'd only killed the Saheeli. Are you guys following what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
So what do you guys think I should be thinking about in that situation?
So he's tapped out at this point, and it's his end of turn?
Yeah, he tapped out for the combo, and I was able to stop it with a K command. I had one K command left in hand, no relevant creatures in the graveyard, and he had one unknown card, having just discarded a Narset. I drew like a Search for Tomorrow or something on my turn.
So he's a five, and he has a K command, and he has one card. Yeah, shock discard seems pretty good in that situation. Basically, if he top decks exactly Saheeli, you lose. If he doesn't, he goes to three, you attack him to two. He has two more draw steps.
Right, two more draw steps to find Saheeli because the Felidar is still there threatening the combo. Or I could just like sit on K-Command for a while and hopefully I'll draw more gas before he does.
Yeah, I mean, K-Command is just like not the best card in this matchup, right? Because your Nivs just tend not to end up in the graveyard. And so the modes just have less range than normal, and so I would be inclined to just fire it off. There's a good chance that the card he has in hand is just another Saheeli.
Yeah, that was my thought process too. I was thinking, like, what cards are better than Narset? And the only thing I could think of were a second Narset, a Teferi, or another Saheeli. So I took that line. I just fired it off immediately to snipe his last card and hit him down to, like, three or something. It turns out that his last card was just another Felidar. I asked him about this after the game. What happened next was that he drew a Saheeli off the top of the deck and killed me. It made me look stupid. I was like, what happened there? Why did you discard the Narset? And he said, oh, I just punted. I thought that was something else. I didn't realize that was a Narset. He tricked me with a punt into thinking that the last card was super important.
I mean, you still have to basically plan out, well, what if the last card in his hand is Saheeli?
If the last card is Saheeli, then I can stop it when he goes for the combo with the K command.
Right, but if he's going to top deck a Saheeli anyway, then he would still win in that scenario. He'd just win one turn later.
You could like top deck like a Remand, or you could top deck a Teferi. There are a lot of things you could top deck that actually would make it harder to snipe the Saheeli with your K-Command disc, 2 damage mode than K-Command 2 discard mode.
I mean, I think you made the right play, Dan, and it just didn't work out, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the right play.
Yeah. This is one of those things against that deck. That deck literally will just sometimes draw the other piece of the combo off the top.
True. Yeah. Splinter Twins. People keep saying they want it to be unbanned. I'm not totally sure why. Like, it's not the best feeling when the game just ends. But
no, it really isn't. The game just ends.
Well, I guess it's over now. I guess I'll sign the match slip. Wish you good luck. He did go on to win the tournament, so shout outs to him. Nice guy.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so that put an end to what had been a sweet run with Niv-Mizzet. I was pretty happy with the build overall. And we'll post this list as well. So I know there's a lot of Niv-Mizzet picking up steam. I think, you know, at least on the Niv-Mizzet Discord, there's a growing consensus that it is no longer a meme deck. It's actually kind of a serious deck. It actually showed up in one of the Magic Online Modern Challenges. It snuck into the top 16 at a 5-2 record, which is a first for Niv-Mizzet. So yeah, I think it's a deck to keep your eye on.
How is its Hogak and Tron matchups?
Oh, you're asking all the hard questions. So Tron is okay because you can interact with Tron via cards like Assassin's Trophy, On Morty, you go retried, crumble to dust, things like that. Basically, you can interact with them. Hogak, it's less clear that you can. That's a lot harder. I was lucky to not play against it. I was looking at my list, like, how would I approach that matchup? There are 12 cards that I would bring in the matchup, and I just don't even know if any of them would have made a difference. So I don't know how that matchup is. So much of the Niv-Mizzet deck is premised on trading, like I said, one for one, or just trying to remove things from the battlefield one at a time. You know, maybe the occasional sweeper, but that just doesn't work against Hogak for the most part. So it's a question of, do you have something more permanent, like a Grafdigger's Cage or a Rest in Peace, and are those good enough? And that's not clear, so maybe that's a good transition to what happened this weekend at the Hogak tournaments.
Yeah, so the Mythic Championship in Barcelona had open deck lists. Is this the second Mythic Championship with open deck lists?
Oh, I guess maybe the Arena one also had open deck lists, I think.
Okay. So what you had on, like, Wednesday or Thursday was pros starting to post what they were playing, and a lot of them were saying that they are going to play Hogak, and that this was the Hogak Pro Tour. Brian Gottlieb even suggested that maybe banning Bridge forced people to make Hogak, quote-unquote, the better way that they should have all along, because they weren't sort of tricked by having the infinite combo, especially after Canister went 11-0 in that Modern Challenge, which we talked about. It was everywhere. It was the most played deck by quite a bit. It was more than twice as prevalent as the second most played deck, which was Izzet Phoenix. And the most played card in all of the Pro Tour 75s was... help me out.
Leyline of the Void,
right. So I did not watch much of the Pro Tour because it was really disheartening to watch a lot of the constructed rounds. I saw the couple rounds I watched had much longer decisions being made in the sideboarding, or should they mulligan, than the games themselves. The Hogak on Hogak matchups with one or two Leylines were more like math problems to figure out what you should be mulliganing to. Yeah, so I don't know. How much of it did you guys watch?
Oh, I watched some. I watched some of the win-and-ins. I woke up in time to watch the finals of the tournament.
I mainly saw on Friday where I think they were trying to feature other decks. I saw a lot of Jund and Tron on camera. I don't know if that was intentional. They just didn't want to show Hogak until they had to. But I don't think I saw much Hogak on camera in the rounds that I was watching, which was surprising.
Well, and to be fair, the players that did quite well with Hogak didn't do that well in draft, even though the average Hogak player actually had an above-average draft record. So the top eight only had one Hogak player, although the most common eight and two deck was Hogak. And the tournament was won by a deck we have not seen a lot of in the pre-bridge and post-bridge banning world, which was Mono Green Tron, which is different than Eldrazi Tron, which is much more common. So I guess one of the positive things I liked about the Hogak presence was it really eliminated the number of times you had to play Tron, but maybe it's back now.
It was like a classic Tron, too. It had four Karn Liberated, none of the Great Creator.
Yeah, somehow it seems that the classic Tron actually has a better matchup against the new version of Hogak Vine than the old version. Because the old version could combo kill you with Altar and Bridge from Below, and that would basically be a little bit too fast for Tron, whereas the current version generally doesn't kill you in one turn, and if you can untap and slam an Ulamog and exile all their stuff, usually that's good enough. And then Tron can pretty easily put in Relic of Progenitus in their flex slots.
Yeah, and I've heard that, you know, Wormcoil Engine is actually quite important in that matchup because they have to actually attack through you. It's actually kind of tricky to do that unless you have a Carrion Feeder. Oathstone actually is a relevant card. You know, it's a fog that takes away a couple threats. Not everything comes back from the graveyard, so there's plenty of ways for Tron to hang around.
And, I mean, like all decks, Tron can play four Leyline of the Void in its sideboard.
It can if you're not playing the Great Creator, which the champion, Terrell Severin, he was not playing the Great Creator, and I think he said after the tournament that those extra sideboard slots made a huge difference for him. You know, he had a full set of Leylines.
Although, I should say that Dominic Harvey won the Star City Games Open playing Mono Green Tron as well, and did play four Leyline of the Void in his sideboard.
Did he have the Great Creator?
No. Four Karn Liberated.
Both major tournaments won by Classic Tron with only the OG Karn Father.
Right. So, I mean, that's kind of exciting to me because I do not really care for the play patterns created by the new 4-mana Karn. Although I don't really like Tron, so maybe I'm just bitching about whatever is happening in this world.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of playing Tron. It just, the games are, I don't know, not the most fun gameplay.
And I do think it is the case, and I know this is true for me, but I think it's also true when you look at some of the other high-performing team cyborgs. They just assume like Tron wasn't that good anymore. So they aren't playing a lot of, you used to have multiple slots in your sideboard that tried to do something about Tron, and nobody does that anymore. And so in the fair matchups or whatever against Jund or something like that, I'm sure they did not meet a lot of resistance. They got to play unmolested Karn Liberated on turn three with the London Mulligan rule very frequently. And that just trumps the Liana or whatever, Blood Raid Elf or Tarmogoyf or whatever the fair players are trying to do.
Yeah, and the thing is that Hogak is a really strong deck, and I think it serves as kind of a gatekeeper to the meta, and then Tron being kind of the other end of things. The modern meta looks in a pretty weird shape. Like basically, there are maybe like eight top decks, and everything else is just really not performing that well. If you look at mtgtop8.com, they have Arclight Phoenix, Humans, Eldrazi Aggro, Red Deck Wins Jund, Blue White, Urza Tron, Urza Thopter Sword combo, and Dredge. Those are all the decks that have more than 2% top 8 share. That's it.
Really? That's only eight decks.
I think it's a bit more of a problem than in modern than it would be somewhere else, because one of the appeals of modern is that it is supposed to be this deep format, this wide open format. And I think Damon's exactly right. Hogak is so powerful as a linear base strategy that you can't get too cute with anything. And if you try to get too cute, then the quote unquote best fair deck, which is Jund, which also got another very powerful tool in Renin 6, it just mops up all the rest of that nonsense. So you're kind of between a rock and a hard place in approaching this specific format. We should also note that the open deck lists plus London Mulligan rule really does have a lot of effect. A lot of the Hogak mirrors came down to people having some of their ley lines main deck and knowing before you even play game one if you needed to sideboard to it or sideboard to specific hands. That helps you beat really linear decks you can't normally interact with, like Neobrand, like Hogak, etc.
Yeah, fortunately, the Neoform deck did not take off. That's the one nice thing.
Yeah, I think it's helped quite a bit by the London Mulligan rule, but it is harmed quite a bit by the open deck list, at least at the Mythic Championship, because players can try to assemble the key cards that actually matter against it and not keep a hand that, has lands and spells and think that they can do something against it.
Yeah, but I mean, even across all the other tournaments, like the MCQs and the GPs and the Modern Challenges, like it's still not actually doing that well, which surprises me because whenever I watch people play the deck, it looks super powerful and like surprisingly consistent.
Yeah, I agree with you. Whenever I beat it, I feel like I really dodged a bullet, but it must be happening to a lot of people because it doesn't win consistently. When you
Yeah.
lose, it just doesn't feel like you got to play Magic, so the experience remains very miserable, even if you beat it.
So I guess the saving grace is that what we're talking about is the Pro Tour and the Star City Tour. These are the spikiest. Is it fair to say they're the spikiest tournaments on the planet?
The Mythic Championship certainly is.
Right. Maybe you could say the weekend tournaments on Magic Online are full of sharks too, but for the common man, for the common brewer like ourselves, the level at which we engage with Modern, I don't think this is a reflection of the Modern that you're going to face if you play a store or just in the Magic Online leagues. It remains true that people just want to be told that it's okay to play fair decks. I've seen so many mid-range decks, both in paper and online. Regular people want to play their Jund decks or their blue-white control or whatever it is. That was true at this tournament that I was at. Like I said, there were 61 players. There were maybe three Hogak decks in the room, and they didn't do well very well. I'm not really sure why. The tournament was won by Jeskai Saheeli and a mono-green aggro stompy deck. I think they split first and second. With like Barkhide Trolls and Stranglergeists and Steel Leaf Champions. It was wild. There was also an Orzhov Martyr proc deck in the top eight. It's a Grixis Urza, Grixis Death Shadow, Blue White Control, and Jund. And then, of course, the other best deck in Modern, Niv-Mizzet. So it was like a wild top eight. And I think people were saying this at the event, they were saying that this gives them some hope for the format. Even Ari Lax, who writes on Star City, but I think he's one of the most on the ball modern writers, he was saying that he thinks that if you just remove Hogak, pretend that deck isn't there, like the rest of Modern is in a terrific place. It's gotten really interesting. A lot of decks have better game plans than they did before.
I'm not 100% sure I agree with him in general, but I guess we'll see. I think Hogak will be banned at the next banned and restricted announcement, but that is after the GP we are scheduled to play and Las Vegas and one other one. So we'll get a lot of data, and I guess we'll find out the I don't want to say the hard way, but maybe that's the only way to say it.
I predict that Hogek will win the GP next weekend, but that we ourselves will just not face it that many times throughout the day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out if I want to be playing Hogek. It almost seems like it's silly not to if the goal is to win.
Well, is that the goal?
Yeah, yeah, right, versus like actually fun playing Magic.
Well, Hogek is a very complicated deck. When you listen to these players describing how they play and the choices they have to make, it is not, you know, a simple deck to just play. I mean, people see, you know, somebody like Canister or whatever just roll through these people. He's making lots of really close decisions. So maybe just as a puzzle, it would be very fun for you to play, Damon.
Yeah, I've never played it before. I mean, I've watched some streams of it, and it definitely looks pretty technical on the mulligan decisions, on the sequencing, etc. More trying to kind of get the most out of your deck than trying to really worry about what your opponent's doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of decisions that if you just choose not to think about them, if you choose not to think about these tricky things, then you can imagine that it's an easy deck to play. But if you're really thinking about it, it actually becomes quite complicated. I saw this tweet from Emma Handy about her experience at the Mythic Championship. She tweeted something like she woke up in the middle of the night after day one and like realized this misplay. There was some complicated line involving holding priority on cracking a fetch to return a blood ghast or something off a lightning axe discard. And all of this was to play around a ravenous trap that the opponent may or may not have had. If you'd taken this exact, really complicated line that I didn't even realize was possible, she could have resolved the Hogek without exposing herself to a trap. And that's the kind of thing that just, it just never occurred to me that that was the kind of thing you have to think about in these post-Cyborg games, whether that's playing around trap or surgical or anything else.
Yeah, using priority to make sure you can resolve your Hogek seems super important with the deck in the face of like surgicals or ravenous traps or other such things. And yeah, that probably takes a good amount of practice to really understand all of those nuances.
Yeah, if you dive into it, I guess you'll be learning all that. Deck choices. Maybe we can segue to a question of the week. This comes from the user Redtrex. This is actually a discussion that I was having on the Niv-Mizzet Reborn Discord channel. So Redtrex writes, in your opinion, is this, namely Niv-Mizzet, the most competitive Faithless Brewing deck? You guys seem to keep coming back to it more than the other decks. Love the podcast, BTW. So I was turning this question over in my mind, and I just wanted to put it to you guys. So is Niv-Mizzet the most competitive Faithless Brewing deck?
That's a hard question in the sense that to be successful requires both kind of a high winning percentage and a lot of repetitions. Decks with the most top eights or whatever may not be the best deck. They may be the most popular deck as a huge confounding variable. But, you know, for example, our Neoform Young Wolf Monkey Form deck, like that deck actually seemed pretty powerful, but we just didn't play it too much after our initial runs with it. And so it's kind of hard to say, like, is that deck as good as Niv-Mizzet? Maybe it's even better. I've been trying the Kiora's Dragons list a little bit more. That deck just cannot beat Hogek. I've given up the Leaky Bucket Prom. I wish that deck would be good because it's a lot of fun, but it's maybe just not there.
Yeah, kind of echoing what Damon said, the Niv-Mizzet list 5-0'd, so that was the first thing. So when people see 5-0 lists, they copy it. And because it used a card that nobody, including myself, I have to admit, thought was particularly viable in Modern, it really seemed to capture the public's imagination. So they have iterated on it. And because so many more people are playing that than, let's say, the Neoform Monkey list, we keep seeing 5-0s every week. Maybe the basic structure of like Niv-Mizzet plus Bring to Light instead of like whatever the Jund value engine is enough that it legitimately exists in sort of like a Jund space. But I often think, you know, that week I played a totally different build of Niv-Mizzet and literally only missed a 5-0 because I didn't have a Wrath effect in my sideboard to Bring to Light for. If I had 5-0'd with that and whatever, Dan had misclicked with his list, would people just be iterating on this possibly much worse 5-0 list that still had Niv-Mizzet in it? So I guess I don't have an answer to that. I don't know how competitive it is vis-a-vis other decks, but because it 5-0'd, it has involved a ton more extra brain power because when the hive mind works on things, you know, it just they just iterate a bunch of times more. And they seem to have found a playable shell with enough variability, especially because it's five colors and it doesn't involve the graveyard. You really have a way to try to answer certain decks that maybe other shells we have, like the Kiora list, just has functional weaknesses that red-green has against certain types of decks.
There's a lot of kind of this cargo culting of deck lists where one really good performance of a deck will get everybody on that kind of same list for a long time. And I mean, part of this is just that if you come along and you're like, oh man, like this build is garbage, I can do way better, watch me, and you build this, and you maybe get like a 5-0, maybe even a couple weeks running. if you don't get like that one kind of big win, people still won't really give it as much respect as a version that perhaps, while inferior, did get that big win.
What are your thoughts, Daniel?
No, I agree with everything you guys are saying. Just the way the question was phrased made me think, like, how many quote-unquote faithless brewing decks are there? We do this podcast every week. Every week we try out at least two lists, sometimes three or four, even five lists. And we talk about how they went, and, you know, they don't usually 5-0, but sometimes they do, but usually not. And I'm just thinking, like, do those decks even exist? Like, if they didn't win, like, I don't think anyone plays them, because people tend to only pick up things that get published as 5-0s. So we've learned some things about our brewers, but we're just three people. The hardest thing for any brewer is getting other people to start sharing their brain power and helping to, like, make a list better. And this is something that, gosh, I'm drawing a blank on this Reddit user's name. I apologize, but they have a deck, they call it Esper Mythseize, that they've been working on for, like, years. It's like an Esper deck with four copies of the card Myth Realized.
Yeah.
So you guys know this card? It's like a one mana enchantment.
Is it like a Pox shell?
No, it's more like a mid-range, just like a mid-range control deck. But every time you cast a non-creature spell, you put a counter on the Myth Realized. They eventually become like these massive threats that only become a creature when you want them to be. But you do have to spend mana on it. So it's kind of a tricky card. But he was saying that he's done all these write-ups on the list and shared all his knowledge and experience, but it's just so hard to get people to pick up the deck. We need help. We need like a brewer's community where people can sort of put their heads together. And thankfully there are forums like, well, Reddit's not really a good place for this because it's just like a constant churn, but Discord channels are really where it's at to get people sort of in the same room thinking about a deck. I'm like, maybe that's what we need. Maybe we need a Faithless Brewing Discord to just sort of think together about these decks and try to make some progress on them, the ones that at least have promise.
I mean, the other reality is because we're trying to produce content each week, we move on, right? So, I mean, I would have happily played Niv-Mizzet in various different shells for a while, but, you know, next week came and Dan said, all right, what do you want to brew for the next week? All right, let's start with Kiora. And that happens a lot of weeks. Even with decks that don't 5-0, I still feel like, oh man, that deck was really sweet. I feel like if I just tweaked four or five cards or, you know, maybe, you know, played better, I would have 5-0'd and I'd feel more comfortable with bringing that deck to a GP. But, you know, duty calls. I mean, each week we have to come up with something novel unless we want to have like a throwback week or something. So, yeah, I think that the only way to iterate on decks is to actually, you know, put in the hours. And we don't have the capacity to do that, especially as we try to explore new cards each week.
Yeah, I don't want to sound too, it's not a problem necessarily. We can't break it all the time. That's a long way of saying that, in my opinion, yes, Niv-Mizzet is probably the best deck that we have created on this cast. Strategically, why is it the best list? I think because it doesn't have vulnerabilities that some of the other lists that we've tried have. On the contrary, it has inevitability in a lot of matchups. It has a lot of easy matchups because it's just sort of a slower control deck that goes way over the top of things. Whereas probably the second best deck, in my opinion, that we've worked on would be either that Bant Monkey Form deck, which has some nice aggro lines. You can get a lot of free wins that way, or the Kiora deck, which also has nice aggro lines. So they each have their own weaknesses. Damon's been telling us a lot about what he's learned about the weaknesses of the Kiora deck. The Bant Monkey Form one, it's a Neoform deck, but it is based on the graveyard loosely. So if they do side in something like a Leyline, your Undying creatures become a lot less good. And unfortunately, you're not going to cruise through a field without facing incidental hate. If not for that, I would say that might be one that is actually quite competitive. We played that a lot the first week. I took it to a 1K and top 80 with that as well. And had a pretty good win percentage on the whole for that deck. And I still think that's quite good. And actually, some of the Yawgmoth lists that we played that we're going to talk about in a minute are kind of like an evolution of that shell, and they're still good. So, yeah, I guess those would be my top three in that order.
Yeah, I think we'll get into some of those lists later. For now, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about our experience with those Yawgmoth lists in the queues.
Thanks to Red Trex for the question. If you guys have a question for us, just get at us. You can find us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Just send a question our way, and we will perhaps answer it on air.
All right, we are back. Last week, we wanted to try out some builds using the new card for Modern Horizons, Yawgmoth, Thran Physician. We kind of had two basic shells. One was sort of a mono black zombies. It had sort of your typical disruption elements, etc. But then also sort of tried to use the undying mechanic with Yawgmoth to set up some infinite combo or value. And then we kind of had, like Dan was discussing, sort of a neoform Undying creature package with various silver bullets, etc. So, Damon, you took the mono black zombies list out for a spin. What were your impressions of that?
Yeah, so there might be a good list lurking within this list, but the deck I played did not feel very good. It felt like it had kind of a kitchen table level of power versus like a modern level of power. And meanwhile, I was doing like the same kind of grindy engines that Hogak has, like the Blood Gas and the Gravecrawlers. Instead of them returning Vengevines in the process or like convoking a Hogak out, they kind of just got back onto the battlefield to be 2-1, and that was it. Yawgmoth would usually come to the table way too late or just not effective enough. I only comboed off once. When I did, it was actually cool. I had fun doing it. but the deck wasn't really geared towards it. And so I went 2-3. I beat Blue-White Control and Hogak Vine. I think the Blue-White Control list was a weird one. It had Thraben Inspector, which is definitely atypical. And the Hogak Vine match I won, I think it was in the 1-3 bracket. And I don't think I was playing somebody who's super versed in the nuances that were keeping Emma Handy up at night. And so I managed to win that one. But then I lost to Hogak Vine, 0-2, Titan Shift, 0-2. There's just nothing in there that can compete with Titan Shift. It's just too slow. And then White Weenie, 1-2. So I feel like you either need to kind of create a more explosive zombie plan or create a more reliable Yawgmoth combo. But without that, it just didn't really do enough. One card we were forgetting that I remember I wanted to add last week was Undead Augur. I think that is one of your better zombie creatures. And it's like a mini Yawgmoth effect on the life loss for drawing a card on creature death.
Can you remind us what is this combo exactly that you're talking about?
Oh boy, yeah. I had to think it through. I went to combat because I was like, this combo won't work. And I was like, wait, mid-combat, oh, I actually can do this. That's cool. Because I thought I had like a blast zone which could go off in response. But yeah, so what happens is if you have 4 cards, you have a Yawgmoth, a Butcher Cool, a Drolf's Messenger, or possibly just any 2 undying creatures, really, and then a Zulaport Cutthroat. What you can do is you sack your first undying creature to give, let's just say, nothing, a -1/-1 counter. You lose a life and draw a card. But then Zulaport Cutthroat says you're going to gain 1 life and your opponent loses 1 life. So all that really happens is your opponent loses a life and you draw a card. And your Butcher Ghoul comes back with a +1/+1 counter. Then you sack your other undying creature to give the first one a -1/-1 counter. So then the new undying creature dies, comes back with a +1/+1 counter. You lose a life, you draw a card, your opponent loses a life, you gain a life, so net you're at 0 life, your opponent lost a life. And then now your original undying creature no longer has a +1/+1 counter on it because the -1/-1 counter neutralized it. And now it's back in action, ready and reloaded, for Yawgmoth to sack this one targeting the second undying creature. So you just keep flip-flopping which undying creature is being sacked to make the other one go back into undying ready. Since each loop involves your opponent losing some life and you not losing life, you should win the game. Unless you deck first, I guess it's like a weird possibility that didn't come up. I guess like Martyr Proc or something weird. And in theory, if you're ahead on life and you just have Drolf's Messenger and Butcher Ghoul, you can do this too because every 2 loops you're going to have your Messenger come back and they lose 2 life. And so if you lose 2 life and they lose 2 life, but you're ahead of them, you'll come out alive and they'll be dead. Unfortunately, this deck just has such a slow clock that that was almost never the case, but it could be the case in theory.
So you found that the ability to play extra disruption wasn't really worth that. So, I mean, you got to play Thoughtseize, Inquisition of Kozilek. The juice wasn't worth the squeeze there, to your experience.
If you look at what, like, you know, Jund plays Inquisition and Thoughtseize, and they just have all these like, kind of, like, high-power level cards in isolation, and this deck has some, like, Gravecrawlers and Bloodghasts. And it's not really doing anything with them. They're kind of just 2-1s. And if you have like a Yawgmoth out there, good fodder for it. If you have a Grey Merchant out, they drain your opponent. But that's kind of it. They're just like Bloodghast to be a recursive 2-1. And it's not like Dredge where you're like flipping over, you know, your whole library to get all 4 Bloodghasts. They're just, you're drawing them. And then incidentally, if your opponent ever has like sideboard ley lines or rips or whatever, then all your undying creatures, like Butcher Ghoul, becomes a 2-mana 1-1. And so, yeah, you have the discard, but the power level of what you're doing is just pretty far off modern's power level, unless you're going for the combo kill, which the deck wasn't really built to maximize. And even then, it's not exactly like, you know, this isn't Devoted Root combo. This is a little bit clunkier. Yawgmoth is a 4-drop, and you need to have like a lot of other moving pieces versus just Devoted Root plus Vizier plus any tutor.
Fair enough. So, Dan, you played kind of a build that was a lot more focused on trying to assemble the pieces to combo, and it had a couple of different other ways to combo that did not involve the graveyard. So what were your impressions of those? I think you played like a Sultai version of the list we discussed last week, and then sort of the four-color combo shell that I proposed, minus or plus a few cards.
Yeah, the fourth color was just white, which allowed a couple of copies of Voice of Resurgence, a Singleton Renegade Railier, and some sideboard stuff like a Knight of Autumn, Gaddock Teague, that kind of thing. So yeah, I guess the similarity to the mono-black list is that the combo works the same way, more or less. You need two undying creatures. The difference is that I can find Yawgmoth a lot faster because I have six copies of Tutors, four Neoforms, two Eldritch Evolutions.
Right, plus the three Yawgmoth themselves.
Right, so there's plenty of ways to get Yawgdaddy into play. The reason why this deck actually felt pretty good, so I guess I went 3-2 both leagues, but the deck felt fine. I was more optimistic than pessimistic about it. Probably because I have a soft spot for Schwengrootgeist and Young Wolf. I think those cards are actually good enough in a lot of situations. Unlike maybe like a Butcher Ghoul or a non-synergistic Bloodghast, I think those cards can be made to be good in certain matchups or game states or with cards like Neoform. They get better when you sacrifice them. They're cheap enough. They have haste. They're aggressive enough that you can actually sort of put pressure on the opponent. So we talked about last week that these four colors especially was a little unfocused. There's a lot of one ofs and two ofs, and it was not totally clear why certain cards got that magic number of one or two next to them. There were primary combos with like a Blood Artist and two undying creatures, or secondary combos with Hapatra and Obelisk Spider, things like that. So I found that Hapatra was just completely useless. Same with the Obelisk Spider. Those were easy to side out every game. I kept the Kitchen Finks in. That's the third piece to like get the -1/-1 counters flowing. I just don't think those cards are needed. I think you can just give those slots to anything else. Like more copies of your undying creatures would be fine. We were playing a Singleton Giraffe's Messenger, which you can tutor up as needed, because like Damon was saying, that allows you to circumvent the need for a Blood Artist. If you're ahead on life, all you need is the two undying creatures and the Yawgmoth to have the Messenger finish them off. You don't need to find that fourth piece. Some of the other lists that have been circulating of this combo, they don't play the Giraffe's Messenger because I guess presumably the mana is too difficult. I think that's a mistake. I think you should play one. I won numerous games with that line of like tutoring up the Messenger at a spot where I was ahead on life. I wouldn't have been able to do a combo if I didn't have exactly the Messenger, because all the other combos require extra pieces.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like having an AAB combo is a lot better than having an AABC combo in terms of just being able to get it online.
Yeah. The other thing that came across pretty well through both of the versions that I was trying was that this deck is really not a combo deck. It is an aggro deck. Its strength depends a lot on how good undying creatures are. It has this Yawgmoth there in significant numbers as kind of a B plan, or not a B plan per se. You can set it up most games, but it's not the thing that puts the deck into the competitive realm. It's like the finisher. Most games are not decided by the combo. A lot of games you have to side out or side down on combo pieces. You need interaction, and the easiest way to find slots for that is to take out combo pieces. The combo itself only works in very limited circumstances. You have to have access to your graveyard. You have to have a good life cushion. And that's just not going to happen a lot of the time. So you end up being sort of like an aggro-y mid-range deck with undying creatures that can draw cards as needed with either Yawgmoth or these recursive threats like the Renegade Rallyer or Eternal Witness, that kind of thing. And every once in a while, you can use the combo to kill a turn or two earlier than you might otherwise have been able to. But it's not truly a combo deck.
Yeah, sort of like our discussion of the Neo Monkey Form list. It has kind of a soft combo that can end the game, but when that all falls apart, you still get to attack, you know, for 3 power on turn 2 or whatever.
There were some cool lines that came up, and a lot depended on the matchup. But like, so against Jund, for example, I just had these great games. Jund is a deck that is trying to kill your creatures, and they just can't do it against undying creatures, especially if you're drawing Neoforms, because then you're doing things like you sacrifice your Phantasmal Image to a Neoform, you get a Renegade Rallier, the Rallier returns the image, copies the Rallier, returns a Geist or something, and then they kill all those, and then next turn you sack the geist with another neoform, get eternal witness, return your rallier, recast the rallier, return the image, copy the rallier, return the geist. It was like a circus. So that felt great. But other matchups, like playing against an amulet titan, it was just a pure race. I didn't have the relevant cards to interact, and neither did they, really. They just went over the top of me. I raced them once and got vastly outraced the other two games. The deck feels a lot better when the cards that you have are able to use their strength in combat. So against humans, like, that was a great matchup because you randomly have Plague Engineer and tutor for it. Yawgmoth randomly has protection from humans, things like that. But matchups that I lost were things like Green Tron. I just couldn't quite goldfish them in time and couldn't quite disrupt them enough. I think I lost a match to Burn where the painful four-color mana base or three-color mana base just did me, and there was just too much shocking and fetching happening. I think I went 1-1 against Burn in my leagues, but yeah, that's a tough one where it made me question, like, what am I really getting out of these extra colors? Like, do I really need them? Because I'm taking a lot of damage, and if anyone ever played a Blood Moon, the game would be well over.
Which extra colors in particular, like white, is the easiest to cut?
White, definitely. You could do the deck even just black-green.
Without Neoform?
Correct. Yeah, it would be a different deck. It'd be a little bit slower. It'd be more like a Undying mid-range. It'd be like a little Jund with an Undying theme. But the card Geralt's Messenger is actually pretty good, as long as the rest of your deck doesn't suck. It's like a nice 2-for-1 that does 4 damage to them. If you had a deck that was, say, some Young Wolves, some Strangler Ogeist, and some Geralt's Messengers, you could still play Eldritch Evolution to find your Yawgmoth. You could even try something like Collected Company, even. We talked last week about a zombie deck that my friend Nick Vallis had been playing, and I got to practice with him a little bit on Friday before this 1K, and I think we were having a similar experience to Damon, where the mono-black version of his zombie deck, it just wasn't quite firing, so we ended up rebuilding a few times. Eventually, he had suggested, hey, what about Collected Company? And we tried that. It was actually kind of interesting. It was kind of promising. Didn't end up playing that build, but it made me think, like, what exactly do I need the blue for? Neoform is great, but the mana gets a lot more complicated, and the blue sideboard cards are kind of non-existent. So you're basically just splashing for Neoform. Like, some of the cuter stuff, like Fibblethip, just didn't come up.
It is also worth saying that Neoform makes your sideboard much better. Even if you don't have any blue cards, it finds your sideboard cards much faster. Being able to turn 2 for Yixilid Jailer, I don't know how you say it, that is quite relevant.
Yeah, even if you go to 2 colors, I mean, you were like, yeah, if we just focus on 2 colors with Strangler Geist and Trolf's Messenger, and that's hard.
That mana base sounds tough.
I mean, like, I guess you can play Twilight Mire, like a bunch of Twilight Myers, and those do a lot of work, but, like, you basically can't play any lands that don't produce black, and you kind of can't play any lands that don't produce green.
Well, I mean, I had both those cards on a 4-color list, and I cast them.
You only had a 1 of the black card, though.
True.
I mean, maybe. I'd be curious to see what the black-green list looks like, and I'm sure you could probably find a place for your old friend Grim Flayer. It's hard to imagine you drawing up a black-green list without that guy.
Well, he probably wouldn't make it in this list. But
oh, wow. That's very disciplined.
He's not synergistic with the Undying plan.
So I think our conclusion is that Yawgmoth is a card that is maybe on the border of modern playable, and if you're going to make a deck specifically built around him, you can't just use his ability sort of passively because it's just a little too slow. So you need to be sort of proactively doing something with it. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
I would say that these decks that we were trying, which were exploring the Undying Eagle specifically, they might have been a little more restrictive. And what am I trying to say? You can use less of Yawgmoth. You can just use him to sack creatures and draw cards, and he's very good at that.
You're not building a deck around Yawgmoth at that point, though.
No, but I mean, basically what we didn't try was the Mardu Pyromancer deck that plays 2 Yawgmoth. And I won't say that those decks are built around Yawgmoth, but, like, it's not clear that these decks are either. He's just, like, a nice role player that can occasionally play the role of a combo enabler, and occasionally can play the role of helping you get ahead on board and draw a lot of cards in the process.
I would say that the one that had the 6 tutors was sort of more built around Yawgmoth.
But then you're saying that you didn't even try to combo with that deck that much.
I went for him often, I just didn't try to combo with him because it's risky to combo. Yeah. Going for the combo costs you a lot of life and board position, whereas if you're doing fine just with the Yawgmoth in play, you're in a much stronger position than you were before because he's a great card in almost all board states. But yeah, so that Mardu Pyromancer deck that just uses him to draw cards, more or less. There was this interesting Jund Planeswalkers deck that had 3 Yawgmoths and then 4 Nissa Voice of Zendikar.
No, the one that makes plants tokens.
And 4 of the new Chandra that makes 2 elementals.
That's cool.
he was an interesting list. It just popped up in the 5-0s a week or two ago. I didn't have a chance to play it. But like that would be another deck where, yeah, they weren't playing any way to tutor for Yawgmoth, and the only thing it really does there is sack the tokens. But I think there have been enough appearances of Yawgmoth that we can confidently say that the card itself is on the modern power level. It's just this question of, like, can we do more to, like, feature him, or should we do more, or should we just sort of not ask too much from him?
And to sort of piggyback on your point, none of the Mardu Pyromancer lists at the Mythic Championship actually played Yawgmoth. They played other cards instead. So they determined, at least, that he was, might be a metagame consideration, etc., not really a card that they wanted or needed in their Pyromancer builds.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, he competes with cards like Bedlam Reveler or anything else you want to do on the top end.
Or just more sweet, sweet Season Pyromancers.
Yeah, it seems like Yawgmoth just has not really found a true home in Modern, but certainly from playing with the card, the power level's there.
I agree.
Well, we'll have to sort of keep exploring, see, I don't know, in a Hogak world, if you want to be using soft graveyard synergies, but maybe in a post-Hogak world, he can have his day in the sun. So we're going to take a little break now, and then we are going to come back with our featured card for next week, which is a Dan Shriver favorite, Watcher for Tomorrow.
Welcome back. We are here to discuss our card for the day, Watcher for Tomorrow. This is a Modern Horizons hit that's a new uncommon. One in a blue for a 2/1 human wizard. It has the hideaway text, which means it enters tapped, strangely enough. And you get to look at the top four cards of your library and take one and put it under it face down and put the rest back onto the bottom. When Watcher leaves the battlefield in any way, it can die, it can be bounced, it can be flickered, etc., you put the exiled card into its owner's hand. So I had the pleasure of playing against this in draft a few times, and it was a powerhouse. And then I played a little bit with it in a Jeskai list that Dan has been championing. Dan, do you want to talk about how you see this card fitting in that list?
Yeah, so this card, it just looked sweet, partly because I didn't realize that Hideaway made it come into play tapped. That's not actually spelled out. It's in italics somewhere in the reminder text for Hideaway. The first time I played with it, I thought the card was bugged because it came into play tapped, and I was trying to make a Saheeli combo and attack with my copy, and I was very disappointed. I panicked, like, oh no, maybe Saheeli's bugged. But yeah, the Jeskai Super Friends, or Jeskai Saheeli, I call it Jeskai Super Cats because it's, you know, got the Felidar Guardian cat. That deck has been like around Modern for a while, but what caught my attention was that Ben Freeman had posted about a nice finish he had with a list. He and Jim Davis had both played it at an SCG event, and he was talking about how the 2-mana slot is a little bit iffy. He didn't mention Watcher for Tomorrow, and I just kept thinking, like, this is the perfect card. This is the perfect card. Because, you know, it has this effect of, as kind of a mini impulse, right? You're looking at your top four. You pick any of them. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be a land, can be a removal spell, can be combo piece, whatever you need. That's an impulse. An impulse is not actually a card that exists in Modern. So in terms of, like, being best in class at what it does, it is sort of in a class of its own. Like, the only card that comes to mind that's similar is Narset, that digs four cards deep, and Narset does not find the full spectrum of cards. So it is doing something powerful if you can get that Hideaway card. And I felt like the Jeskai Super Friends deck had critical mass of ways to unlock the hidden away card, I guess. That includes play as a Saheeli Rai, -2 to make a copy of a creature, and the copy will then die at the end of the turn. So you can lead Watcher for Tomorrow into Saheeli and actually immediately get great value out of her minus, which is otherwise, she's usually just a blank. All she does is scry if you're not exactly comboing with Felidar Guardian. She combos with the Watcher. Felidar Guardian blinks any permanent, like Damon was saying, that will get you the Hideaway card. You'll have a second one stashed away too. And Teferi Time Reveler also does that. You can bounce your Watcher for Tomorrow and get the Hideaway card that way. This was in the early days of Modern Horizons. At the time, the meta was still skewed toward these new War of the Spark Planeswalkers, where I think we'd all sort of come to the understanding that you need to put cards on the board that can pressure something like a Karn or an opposing Teferi or Narset. And I felt like that was missing from the Jeskai list, so I really liked the way that Watcher worked with the cards that were already in the deck and helped it play to the board a little bit quicker, both to defend your own Planeswalkers, potentially, or pressure opposing Planeswalkers.
And to piggyback on your point, the two drops people were playing, like, I saw Nassif 5-0 when he was splashing green to play Coiling Oracle in that slot, and he was really taking a ton of damage from his lands to do that. to try to kind of paper over the weaknesses of the two slot to also get value out of the Saheeli Rai. So this letting you stay in Jeskai is a real value.
Yeah, although the green list he was playing also got to play Oath of Nissa, which was pretty interesting with all the Planeswalkers, which would kind of help alleviate the mana base problems. Jeskai Saheeli is an interesting deck. Like, it had a kind of a brief moment of glory in Modern a couple months ago, where like for 2 weeks it became like a big deck that people were worried about, people were getting top eights with, and then things like Hogak happened, and we kind of lost track of the deck. So yeah, the question is this a good Modern deck right now, and is Watcher for Tomorrow a good card in the deck? I'm certainly sold on the promise of Watcher. I did try this deck actually a while back with Dan, and we came up with the phrase Tomorrow Never Dies, because what he didn't mention with the Saheeli combo is you play your first one, and you look at your hand, and you're like, okay, well, out of these four cards, like, what is going to be good for me? You know, my hand currently only has one extra land to get to three. I might need to get to four lands to play my Felidar Guardian. Or I could just take a Felidar Guardian, or I could take a, you know, like, Opt-type card or whatever. And then it's like, I don't know when this Watcher's going to die. And so as a result, like, I don't know if I can take a land now because I might not get it when I need it. And Saheeli does crack a Watcher, but not your first Watcher. It creates a new one that's going to get cracked. And so somehow, like, your first Watcher is a very confusing impulse. It's the weirdest impulse you've ever had because you don't know when you're going to get access to that card. That said, the ability to chain these tutors, like, digging four is a lot. And Teferi and Felidar Guardian both do reliably get you the card immediately. And the Singleton Mox Amber is interesting. It lets you go off a little bit easier, just a little bit more explosively. And I'm blanking on the specific interaction with Felidar Guardian versus just a land.
So it's actually an interaction with Saheeli. It allows you to combo off with just five lands in play. You play Saheeli first, play the Mox and make a mana. Then Saheeli can copy the Mox. You'll have to throw away the original Mox. But with the Mox copy, you'll now have the four mana you need to cast Felidar Guardian. It's not like a huge thing, but you can go from an empty battlefield with just five lands. You can go from empty battlefield to combo kill. Whereas normally you'd have to, you can only do that on six lands if you didn't have the Mox Amber. But I'm not sure that that card is worth it. I mean, it's kind of fidgety. It's only enabled by these Planeswalkers that are already high-value targets for them to kill. I don't think playing something like Fibblethip is really worth it.
Not even as a one-off?
You can put it as a one-off, and it'll probably just get sided out.
Yeah, so the other cards that these decks tend to play in their two-drop slot that's so contentious is some combination of Spreading Seas, Wall of Omens, Coiling Oracle. You could probably even consider like Arkham's Astrolabe or something like that.
That's an interesting idea. That's another thing that you can blink or copy for value off of all those cards we mentioned, Teferi, Saheeli, and Felidar. Maybe that's worth considering. I think the Nassif list that you were talking about, Dave, was pre-Horizons.
Yep.
So maybe that's something we should draw that up and try it. The straight Jeskai build, we were talking about this weeks ago, and it wasn't really related to our regular schedule. It was just something that intrigued me, so we played it. Since then, I've seen some other Jeskai lists that do incorporate some number of Watcher for Tomorrow, and I'm guessing not because of our podcast. I think they independently arrived at that conclusion. So it's kind of a card in the mix. They were playing it as a 2-of, I was trying it as a 4-of. We can do a little bit better in terms of like deciding, do we want this card or not? For that reason, I want to play 4 and more ways to crack it. But yeah, I think that it's competing with other stuff we should also be exploring, like the Ice Fang or the Astrolabe.
One unwritten rule that we're mentioning here is that in theory you can play any 2-drop or any card at all in this slot. But the reason to play these 2-drops we're talking about compared to like, you know, like Tomiko Neighborhood Advocate, whatever they got, just a generic 2-drop, is that sometimes you just have this Felidar Guardian on an empty board and it flickers a card, and it's just really good to have these flicker targets that let you go up a card somehow. Versus playing a Felidar Guardian to untap a land to do nothing with is pretty unexciting. And so making your Felidar Guardian have a free impulse attached really makes the deck smooth out a lot, because even if you know killed your first Saheeli and all you have is your other half of the combo, if that half of the combo digs you four cards, that's actually pretty good. And so this isn't like a hard rule, but it's just sort of the way the deck has typically taken shape.
True. This shell is kind of a proven shell, and I like how it has the ingredients necessary to allow Watcher for Tomorrow to succeed. There's, I think, more potential for Watcher that he could maybe even go in other shells. Dave, you had some thoughts on what else we can do with this. Should we talk about one of the lists that you've drawn up?
Yeah, so I knew that Watcher for Tomorrow is a card you're always interested in, and I was looking through one of the 5-0'd deck dumps, and I saw that somebody had 5-0'd with a list that had, like, Watcher Tomorrow, Ethervile, and a bunch of Blink effects. I think Saffron Olive is actually playing that 5-0 list this week, maybe. So I sent that to you, and then I saw Andrei Strosky, who has played at the Mythic Championship. He's a wonderful young Czech player. He had a screenshot that had Ephemerate with Watcher for Tomorrow in play and said, what if Dig Through Time cost 3 mana? And that looked really intriguing to me. So I'm always trying to find ways to play Restoration Angel, as you guys know. So I kind of started like tooling around with a Blink shell, and I noticed that Nassif had kind of been intrigued by sort of making an Eternal Command-like list similar to the 5-0 list. And he recommended the loop being, instead of sort of like cryptic commands over and over again, to play Time Warp with Eternal Witness, and that gives you multiple ways to go infinite if you are willing to play Soul Herder or Ephemerate. So I kind of combined all those together into this sort of Bant Blink shell. It combines some ideas from, like I said, Nassif, the sort of original inspiration from Andrei Strosky, and the original 5-0 list. Basically, you have a list that's just playing all these value creatures. So on 2, you have Coiling Oracle, Ice Fang Codal, Watcher for Tomorrow. You're playing 4 Ephemerates, so you've got just a jillion targets for it. And then you have Soul Herder, which helps you constantly bounce creatures every turn. It itself gets huge. So it's worth noting it triggers when you path one of their creatures. It triggers every time Ephemerate resolves. It triggers when Restoration Angel bounces a creature or when Flicker Wisp bounces a creature. If you have Rest in Peace in play and a creature goes to the graveyard and gets exiled, it's also triggered by that if that interaction ever comes up. The other thing that I thought was key that Nassif wasn't doing is I think you need a little bit more acceleration than just the 4 other vials. And Utopia Sprawl is like a 1-drop that doesn't die to Renin 6, which I have found to be like a super oppressive card in the format. It also fixes your mana. It leaves you a lot less vulnerable to sort of Wrath effects, which this deck is a little soft to. So yeah, I've tooled around with a different shell. This is kind of where I've landed after a league. The deck is super fun to play. I'm still not 100% sure how good it is or like what all the sideboard slots are, but it's pretty sweet when everything kind of comes together.
I saw the Eternal Witness Time Warp loop in the Canlander once, but instead of Soul Herder at the top, and they use Progenitor Mimic. But the idea is the same, where basically every turn you get a copy of your Eternal Witness, and then the Eternal Witness gets a Time Warp back, so you take another turn, and then this gives you infinite turns. So that's a pretty cool interaction. Soul Herder, though, that's cool. It's definitely it was a limited, just busted card.
What made it so good in limited? I mean, it's just a big dude. It looks like it flies, but it doesn't actually fly.
Yeah, it doesn't fly. I was fooled by that. I am notoriously fooled by cards that look like they fly and don't actually have flying.
Yeah, that's some spooky, spooky art. What makes it powerful is just that in limited, having a kind of Planeswalker-esque card where you go up one card every turn is really powerful. You almost always, in Modern Horizons draft in a blue-white deck, will have some sort of card that makes heavy value out of being flickered, whether it being a regular Cohort or Blizzard Strix or any number of other cards like that, or Mana War. There's almost always a good target for it. And so your Soul Herder gets huge. Meanwhile, you get to like bounce a creature every turn, or Pondering Mage is another good one. Any sort of engine in Magic where you draw one card a turn more than your opponent is really powerful. That's what Planeswalkers do. That's what Jace the Mind Sculptor does, with a little bit of brainstorming and bouncing. But Planeswalkers also get killed by creature combat. And so in this deck, you're basically almost certainly going to have a good Soul Herder target between the Coiling Oracles, the Coattles, the Watchers, the Witnesses, Knight of Autumns.
It also gets huge super fast. Like, I won a bunch of games where I was just doing enough to sort of survive against Hogak or whatever. And then all of a sudden, you path twice, Ephemerate again on your upkeep, and all of a sudden you're attacking with like an 8 or 9 power Soul Herder, and of course none of their creatures can block. You do all of a sudden just get a threat. It gets out of Lightning Bolt range, you know, very quickly. Yeah, people don't realize if you path to exile one of their creatures, they Soul Herder still gets a +1/+1 counter there.
So I like a lot of the cards in this list. It seems really sweet. I don't like the numbers of the particular cards. I feel like if I were trying to build this deck from scratch, I might end up in a similar place and I would get frustrated. I tend to get really drawn to a synergy package of 2, 3, 4 cards, and I think of more cards that could fit in that shell that also have some synergies. And I just keep adding more and more cards to like this list I want to build until I just have too many cards. When we're setting out to build like a Blink deck, you run into a similar problem where there's a bunch of cards that each category value creatures that blink or things that can blink something interaction or whatever you need. They're just like more cards than can or should fit into a deck. And then at a certain point, you're like, wow, am I doing this right? Like, you have these three soul holders are cool, but they come at the expense of Flicker Wisp, which is a one of. So like, maybe it should just be four Flicker Wisps. Like, maybe that's just a better card than Soul Herder, or the other way around. The two slot, Coiling Oracle, Ice Vein Coil, Watcher for Tomorrow, all great, but like, do we really need all three? And is this the right number of them? Maybe we should just pick the two best ones and go with those.
Yeah, so like I said, this is for me actually like playing a league or two with these. Flicker Wisp is functionally like a third Night of Autumn to make sure you don't get destroyed by Chalice, but it also doubles as a bad Soul Herder. It also flies to attack Planeswalkers, which has been a major issue. This deck struggles to kill them. Watching for Tomorrow started out as I was just running 4/4/4. The fact that it comes into play tapped really matters. It matters a lot more than I would have thought. So with Soul Herder, basically, you get your value, but you can't actually block, and you don't want to block with Soul Herder for a while. You could play more 2-drops. I would play more cheaper creatures that do stuff. I thought of even playing like a 1-of Wall of Omens or Wall of Blossoms, just because sometimes people kind of get ahead of you in the tempo race. I mean, you actually have inevitability, weirdly, even though you don't have that many cards that cost more than 3 mana. So I'm not saying that these cards are locked in at a number, but they weren't arrived at arbitrarily. Even the one of Arkham's Astrolabe was just another card to like help fix the mana, make sure I can cast Oriok Champion or Familiar's Ruse. Utopia Sprawl, I had more of at first, but you don't need that many mana sources in the deck. Another interesting way to build the deck would maybe not be to have Ethervile and just try to like maybe play 22 lands and like 3 Utopia Sprawls and then turn the extra slots you gain there into more like value creatures.
Well, how about increasing the number of 1-drops? I was thinking that you don't have enough 1-mana plays, but you're saying you'd be willing to even reduce the number of 1-mana plays.
The 1-mana plays that I've seen other people play are like our favorite investigator, Mr. Thraben Inspector. That card just doesn't do it for me. I don't want to play Noble Hierarch, and I found Utopia Sprawl to... I don't want to play any more of those because there's too many mana sources. So Arkham's Astrolabe is kind of like the hedge. It like hopefully draws you into something else. It still can maybe help prevent flooding, but also fix your mana at the same time. And I don't want to play actual mana creatures because you're already so soft to Wrath, and like I said, Renin 6 is a nightmare.
Cutting Aethervile, you just only have 21 creatures in this list, which doesn't quite seem like enough to really leverage Aethervile.
I think cutting Aethervile is crazy. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but you got to do something on turn one. You just have to.
I like Utopia Sprawl a lot, to be honest.
So you have 4 Utopia Sprawl, but that's not enough on turn one. You got to do more than that. I think you should play 10 1-drops in any modern list, unless you're like a very slow control deck.
For reference, humans play as an Aethervile deck. They play 37 creatures.
They're a great Aethervile deck. This would not be a good Aethervile deck, but this would still make use of the card. I mean, it's either that or play Noble Hierarch, which... it sounds like we don't want to do.
I think that I would start off with maxing Utopia Sprawl. I could see maybe playing, you know, Banned Spirits almost always played 3 Aethervile. And even they have 29 creatures. So someone playing 4 Aethervile in a deck with this few creatures seems crazy to me. I would say that maybe you could have, like, you know, the kind of Sylvan Library style, like one of, like one Aethervile. The first one you draw is much better than the second one. But I have trouble just wanting that card with so few creatures. Like, you need to get a lot of activations out of it to make it really powerful. A lot of these creatures you even want to be playing on your main phase, like because of Soul Herder.
Yeah, so stuff to explore. Exactly.
One card that I'm curious about, actually, is Stoneheart Dignitary.
Definitely a card I considered.
Oh, God. Not that. Please.
Maybe just in the sideboard, though. I just feel like, actually, current Hogak lists rely on the combat step. And if you could use that to buy you a bunch of turns with Ephemerate, like, that's interesting. And that plus Soul Herder is a lock in terms of creature combat.
Yeah. So 1/4, I'm 0/4. If I'm casting a 1/4/4, I want it to either make a large construct token and tap for mana, or I want it to combo kill them instantly with the Saheeli.
Well, you came to the wrong deck. This deck has a different infinite combo.
So other cards I considered as like one-ofs was like Renegade Rallier, like I said, Wall of Blossoms, Wall of Omens. You could play Thraben Inspector, although I would not recommend it. The list that 5-0'd had a little bit different configuration, but they played a bunch more Familiar's Ruses.
And 2 String of Disappearances.
Yeah, so this deck replaces that with Ephemerate. Ephemerate has been awesome, so I'm not interested in cutting that card. But you could cut Familiar's Ruse, you could cut Astrolabe and the Utopia Sprawls and play creatures in all those slots. You could even play one time warp if you just didn't really care about the combo until like super late game. And you could turn all that into more things to take advantage of Aether Vial, or like I said, you can cut the Aether Vial entirely.
Modern Horizons draft superstars. Like, have you considered Settle Beyond Reality? That card is insane. And like, I'm actually like not completely joking. I think it's not quite modern level, but like, man, that card is just like such a beating. If you use that to exile their best creature and then meanwhile flicker your like Eternal Witness or your Watcher or anything really, it's such a tempo swing.
If you curve Stonehorde Dignitary into Settle Beyond Reality, you kill a creature and they can't attack next turn. Booyah.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird how like modern can support both these weird value plans and the like ruthless one-shot combo kills. And there's reasons to go for combo kills and reasons to go for the value plan. I mean, Jund does not want to have infinite combos. It wants to be more resilient. Combos typically are more fragile. And so even though Stonehorde Dignitary is not as good as Felidar Guardian with a Saheeli, it is more reliable. It'll be interesting to try this deck out.
Well, this deck, to me, I'm not too optimistic for it because it's not Jund. And I think hearing you lump them together, I don't think that's the right way to think about Jund. Jund is not a grindy value deck. I mean, it has those elements, but it's a disruptive deck that tries to kill them before it stops the first three things they do and tries to kill them before the fourth thing they do. And this deck doesn't really try to kill them ever. You're just trying to blink for value. I do like the Time Warp loop for that reason, because that does kill them.
Yeah, I do wonder what the right number of Time Warps is.
Deck looks sweet, though. Having said all that, it looks totally sweet.
Another avenue you can take is the original list that Shota Yasuoka played at one of the worlds. Even played Big Drinks to get rid of extra Aether Vials, because he also did not play that many creatures. I think he played 19, even. So the ability to like turn Aether Vials into something else is kind of interesting.
You're saying that this is a spiritual successor to Shota Yasuoka's Eternal Command list from 4 years ago?
Yeah, I love that deck. That is like one of my favorite decks of all time.
Can you remind people what that deck is? I don't think most people are familiar with that off the top of their head.
Okay, so I might even get the event wrong. There was a Worlds that Shota Yasuoka dominated the Swiss portion of, playing a list that had four Aether Vials, and it was like all value creatures. So I think it was like Snapcaster Mage, Tarmogoyf, Eternal Witness, V-Click, and I think that was it. And then he played like cheap interactions like Lightning Bolt, Spell Snare, Mana, Leak, Remand, etc. And then four Cryptic Command, and like I said, one or two Thirst for Knowledge. I don't have a list in front of me. He would, you know, kind of play the normal like sort of teamer box value game, trading one for one. But then eventually he'd set up loops where he could like Vial in Eternal Witness, Cryptic Command, counter the spell of the opponent and blink his witness. And as soon as he started being able to do that, like the tempo gains he would get from that would just pull him way ahead. So he would start getting like two and three and four for ones. The sort of Snapcaster, Eternal Witness back, Snapcasters, cast Snapcaster, flash in, you know, bolt, and then all of a sudden you're attacking for four. I mean, the lines were just super cool. Modern is a different beast these days. You can't play Magic anymore, so you can't really do that kind of stuff. Cryptic Command is, like, really bad right now. But yeah, people should check it out. I just remember him absolutely destroying John Finkel playing, like, a blue-white list, and it just wasn't even close. It's a beautiful thing to see.
We'll post a link to Shota Yasuoka's Eternal Command.
2012 Player Championship, so 7 years ago.
Seven years ago, and we're still talking about it here today. So we have one last list to talk about with Watcher for Tomorrow, and here it is a four of. Dave, tell us about this last build.
So this is more of like a deck building exercise. When someone tells you, all right, I want to maximize a card, like Dan was saying, you need to figure out a way to, let's just assume you can do the card's thing as much as you can. Is that even good enough? So the way to do that is to, I think, like build in all these other cards that naturally interact with that card and just see if that turns out to be good enough. Now, I don't think that's the case for this particular deck, but so this deck plays a blue-white or Azorius Hate Bear Shell. So it's playing Folly Garden of Thraben. It is playing Lavinia. I think people are really underrating this card. It's very good against Hogak. They just can't cast it. Displacer, Flicker Wisp, Soul Herder, and Restoration Angel. All of those cards typically are just used for these like cute little plays historically in normal shells where you're talking about Hate Bears. But when, as Damon and Dan were talking about, when you're actually blinking Watcher for Tomorrow, you're actually getting a 3-mana 3/1 that casts Impulse. That card is super powerful. So it's just letting you flip through your deck with all these extra abilities of the Watcher for Tomorrow interaction, hopefully, that's a theory, to sort of try to find, you know, whatever, the cards that you need in any given matchup. It also has kind of an interesting card, which is Hallowed Moonlight. I don't think this card is good enough for Modern, but I think it's a card that people should at least consider with the Devoted Druid shells and all of the Dredge and Hogak lists. It has a lot of utility. It basically functions as sort of like a two-mana counterspell that cantrips, or at least delays them for a turn. And with Flicker Wisp or Eldrazi Displacer, it's just straight up two-mana, remove a creature from the game, draw a card. So if you're already going to play all these other cards to try to maximize your Watcher for Tomorrow, I think it's sort of worth playing a card like Hallowed Moonlight, which always cycles as a worst-case effect. So yeah, just sort of a rough shell here that is perhaps worthy of investigation.
I like the Spell Queller. I like the kind of core build of the deck, and like the idea of Eldrazi Displacer plus Spell Queller plus Luvinia just like lets you just block out a lot of their spells. You have not convinced me on Hallowed Moonlight. That card is just not as good as it looks. It's like not a Containment Priest. It's not even close to Containment Priest. There's too many May effects. So like Bloodghast, they can just choose not to put in the battlefield, and all you've done is slow down their Bloodghast for like turn.
And Vengevine is a May, and Phoenix is a May, etc.
I think Phoenix is not a May.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the only one that isn't.
I think Vengevine is also not a May.
No, Vengevine is a May.
Yeah, Vengevine's a May.
Jeez, can't catch a break.
Malakim is not a May. I just don't like this card that much. I think it just doesn't do enough. Even with your Displacer thing, that's still like 5 mana you need to exile one creature.
Exactly. It's not really a 2 mana play in those scenarios. It's a 5 mana play. The history of this card, I think it was printed in Magic Origins, I want to say. It was printed as kind of a hate piece for like the Collected Company standard metagame when Company was just dominating. Even then, people tried it and just stopped playing it because it just wasn't good enough, even when it had a very specific and dominating card that it could wipe out. And like Dave's saying, it did always cycle, so you can always talk yourself into putting it in, and it just wasn't good enough in standard. So I think it won't be good enough for modern, and I will be happy to just replace those with Eldrazi Displacers or Restoration Angels. Those cards I like a lot with everything else happening here. This seems like a great Aetherwild deck. I'm happy to see it here as a 4 of. It's got these nice mana sinks, namely the Displacer, and then the Flicker Wisp becomes extremely good when you have Vylon 3.
Yeah, I like Aethervile a lot more in this deck. I do wonder if you could play 3 instead of 4, just because, again, your creature count isn't sky high.
Stop cutting Aethervials. What's going on here? What happened?
It's too easy to lose games with, like, 3 Aethervials in play. One of the reasons that you get free wins off spirits or humans is when they just draw too many Aethervials.
Yeah, you started to say 2 Aethervials, and then you stop yourself and said, actually, 3 Aethervials, because 2 is fine. It's not great, but it's fine. Like, 1 is so good. It's such a huge difference for any kind of Taxes-style strategy.
The main reason I like this list is it doesn't play the garbage fucking Jesus cats that I just absolutely hate, and so I will never, ever play that card again.
Wait, sorry, for our listeners, who is the garbage fucking Jesus cat?
Lean and Arbiter. This is the card we're talking about.
Lean and Arbiter.
Ah.
I'm not interested in playing Lean and Arbiter and attacking the mana base of decks like Hogak that can already have a dominating board presence on turn 2 or 3 and don't need that many mana to function. I think make that sort of strategy functionally very weak in this format. And the presence of Renin 6, again, another Modern Horizons, I would say mistake, but powerful card in the meta, makes you just don't get the free wins off of it, and you will get a lot of times where you're playing a 2-mana 2-2 with no abilities.
I'm not totally sure about that. Hogak actually has pretty soft mana to some extent, and they play a lot of fetch lands to help find the various, because they need to have black mana and green mana and red mana, and some of us even need blue mana, and they want to do this in a deck that plays like 18 lands total.
They are heavy on fetch, vulnerable to Blood Sun and Blood Moon. So I can see what you mean about the Arbiter being useful there, but he tricks you. It's such a tricky card. Not hard to play, but like tricky as in he will trick you into thinking it is a playable card, and it's just going to let you down. I hate that card as well, if that's not clear.
You can slot in for Lean and Arbiter if you like, Demon. I won't begrudge you that opportunity.
I mean, just like one concern I have with this build is that can you beat Tron at all? I mean, game 1, it looks impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I will say Luvinia is okay against Tron, but you don't have a lot of cards that interact favorably with them. That is fair.
So Luvinia basically slows down Karn and Ugin, but not Ulamog.
Correct.
And they can Osona at any time and just wipe your stuff.
Tron has always been the bane of any kind of creature-based deck like this.
Well, like the Lean Arbiter with like 4x Ghost Quarter, that at least does something against Tron. I don't know if it's like enough, but it does get you somewhere.
I mean, that would be a blue-white Taxes deck, and you would probably cut Lavinia and Watch Over Tomorrow to make room for that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that's not a viable strategy. It just moves away from what we're trying to learn, I guess, from this list. But maybe not. I mean, maybe you can have it all. Maybe you can find room for Arbiter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be the champion of Lean Arbiter if you guys hate it.
I'm not going to play it, but I welcome anyone else who would like to put together a 4 Lean Arbiter list to explore what happens.
Yeah, I think that, I guess, the number of cards that interact with Watcher is something that we'll have to track. Like, how many do you really need to have critical mass? I was talking about how I felt like the Jeskai Saheeli deck had critical mass because it had 12 cards that naturally blink it. You can block with it, of course, in a pinch, or even bolt it if you really have to. This deck has, well, I'm counting some Displacers, some Flickerwisps, some Soul Herders, some Restoration Angels. Between them, 10 cards that can blink the Watcher. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
So we'll see if that turns out to be enough, or if we end up either increasing the number of blink cards or shaving Watchers to a smaller footprint of the deck.
If you flicker your Watcher for tomorrow, it's kind of like 3 mana for 3 on Flyer with an Impulse attached. But what really is happening is it's 3 mana for 3 on Flyer with an Impulse that was cast 3 turns ago, like outcome that you're going to get in your hand. And then it will recast a new Impulse where you're going to get that card in some unknown future point in time, which is not the same as an Impulse.
Well, is it better or worse? I mean, you know exactly what you're going to get.
The difference, though, is that it's a way more tempo-positive play than Teferi Time Raveler bouncing your own Watcher. So you're left with a 3-mana Planeswalker on the battlefield with one loyalty. To Damon's point, you don't want to, fall in love with the idea of getting to cast, quote-unquote, all these Impulses, because it's like Impulse with Delay 3 or whatever.
Yeah, you get to know the card in advance, which is sort of better than an Impulse because you know what you're getting. But it's worse in the sense that the card you chose a couple turns ago may not be the card you would choose at this turn. So, interesting thing to keep an eye on with Watcher for Tomorrow. Just how does this ability work? Like, how often are we able to reliably be picking the best choice now that stays the best when we want it or when we get the card?
Another play which is unintuitive but comes up a lot is pathing your own Watcher to get the card underneath it. It's a card neutral play. You get a land to replace your path and you get whatever card was underneath Watcher to replace it. So against a deck like Tron or, you know, whatever, blue-white or something, where you need a specific card that interacts with them and, you know, your sort of normal plan of playing these 2 and 3 power creatures doesn't matter, that's something you should not be hesitant to do.
One thing I can tell you about playing with Watcher for Tomorrow is whenever you have a Watcher for Tomorrow in play, you're going to look at that card and be like, I want that card. I don't want this 2-1. I want that card. How do I kill my own Watcher? And that's going to be going through your head the whole game while the Watcher's in play. You could be ahead, like, fighting lethal, and you'll still be thinking, like, why is my Watcher still alive? How do I get this guy off the battlefield? I want that card. And then you look at the path in your hand and be like, I want that card, and I could use a land. Maybe the card on the Watcher will be another path, and you'll be like, I could turn this path into another path. It'll drive you a little crazy. It's kind of funny.
So we've outlined kind of the possibilities and limitations of Watcher, but it's a matter of finding shells that are plausible on their own that also support this card or perhaps are supported by this card. And I think we've outlined some plausible takes, and I think there are more that we could, you know, who knows, maybe if we have time, we'll explore something else. But any final thoughts on this card?
I don't know how good any of these shells will be, but Watcher for Tomorrow is like a super fun card, and I'm looking forward to playing each of these lists in their various permutations.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how Soul Herder performs. It just is a really interesting card. And with Watcher, I mean, it seems quite good, but it's just like Modern is a brutal place right now.
If we can make Soul Herder into a Modern staple, then any excuse to pick up foil copies of that card, because it looks sick. That's about wraps up what we had to say about these decks. Hey, listeners out there, if you have some ideas for Watcher for Tomorrow, get at us. We'd love to hear them. Send us your lists, and we'll take a look.
Oh, one more thing, sorry. Watcher for Tomorrow's ability is triggered, so you don't necessarily get it. If they kill it in response to the Hideaway trigger, you don't even get your card at all. That has come up a couple times. You don't always get your card.
That's the fine print to our long infomercial on Watcher for Tomorrow. Slide that in at the end.
Yes.
You can't fail to find, right? You have to put one in exile?
Correct.
You do. So, that being said, yes, Watcher for Tomorrow. We'll check back next week with how it did.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you then.
Take her easy.
See ya.
that'll do it for episode 14 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the decks that we discussed on today's show are posted in the show notes, which you can find in the episode description of your preferred podcast player. If you have questions or feedback for us, we would love to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG, email us faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or find us on Reddit at r/modernmagic. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.